Sunrise will be at 7:50, sunset at 4 p.m. The weather early next week will still be cold at around 2 degrees Celsius.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Sunwell News, aimed at the blind and visually impaired community living in and around Sunwell. And this edition is due with you on Saturday, November the 22nd.
Some highlights from this week's Express and Star. In Wednesday's news, ambulance boss frustrated by hospital handover delays, free liver health checks. Thursday's news, West Bromwich building Osiety, helping to combat loneliness. Doctors and staff set to stage walk out. Poor lighting contributed to bus accident tragedy. Friday's news, IKEA meatball home delivery service. Man tried to launch firework from his backside. Traditional lollipop crossings to be replaced by zebras. Saturday's news, which Baggies players might stay or go when out of contract. All change on the buses for routes 74, 87 and 126. Johnny Rotten raves about orange chips. Monday's news. Food bank delight as building society gives support. Improvements to West Midlands ring and ride service welcomed. The Express and Starlands Award. Letter from a reader. Bring Pack Nature Reserve partnership. Tuesday's news. Freddie Mercury celebrated. Merry Hill Festive Market.
Well, are you up for going to the Merry Hill Festive Market? Well, not for me, but I'm sure quite a few of you might be interested in that. Be even easier when the tram goes there. Those were just a few of the headlines coming up courtesy of Express and Star Publications. And along the way, we'll include, as usual, a rundown of the audio described TV listings for the week ahead, as well as radio listings. And after that, I'll be squeezing in the latest SVI Christmas activities. And there'll be one or two other items from TNF, who this week are providing the quiz. Sarah Ann has got more than a touch of laryngitis, I'm afraid. Well, on to the first day's news then from James.
This is James Brodie bringing to you stories from the Express and Star, dated the 12th of November. Help our families through the Salvation Army's toy appeal. This story is brought to you by Ajo Ato. Supporting this article is a picture of a child who is opening up a present with the title Christmas Present Appeal by the Salvation Army is ongoing in the Black Country with many collection points. The Salvation Army is calling on the communities in the Black Country to share love and hope this Christmas, donating new toys to its children's present appeal. Every year, Salvation Army churches ask people to donate new toys and gifts for children whose families are already making impossible choices between food, heating and bills. Last year, Birmingham, the Black Country Salvation Army distributed more than 1,180 toy parcels containing over 7,500 individual gifts, with the church and charity fearing more people will need support this year. A spokesman for the Salvation Army in the Black Country said, "Our Christmas present appeal is an opportunity for people in our community to embrace the spirit of Christmas, a gift to families and individuals who have very little. Christmas is meant to be a time of love and joy, but for many, it's a time of stress and despair when financial worries are brought into sharp focus for families who are struggling to heat their homes, let alone provide presents for their children. The Christmas present appeal is how we put our belief into action, showing love where it's needed most. We believe every child deserves an experience of joy on Christmas morning. We're always overwhelmed by the generosity of the public in supporting our appeal each year, and we hope to continue to do this to ensure that children wake up on Christmas Day with a smile on their faces. The Salvation Army in the Black Country includes its church in Albury, Dudley, Willenhall, Darlaston and Cradley Heath. Each church is partaking in the Christmas present appeal with dedicated drop-off points available, giving pages for online donors and festive community events for local families to attend. The Salvation Army will sort and distribute the gifts to children and families in the respective areas through local groups, schools and social services. Gifts can include anything from educational toys, baby clothes, bath toys, books including learn to read books for babies and toddlers, to dolls and action figures, sports equipment and clothing, toiletries, gloves, scarves, hats, t-shirts, hair accessories and gift vouchers for older children. Salvation Army's church halls and charities will be taking donations many until Sunday, December the 7th. And collections will also be taking place on Christmas events where the Salvation Army are attending. Donations can also be made through the Entertainer's Big Toy Appeal until November the 29th. Customers can buy an extra toy to donate when they visit a store or shop online at thetoyshop.com. The Entertainer will also add a toy, doubling the number of children who might go without. Each Entertainer store is connected with a local Salvation Army church or centre who will collect and distribute the toys to those in need as part of the wider Christmas appeal. Ambulance boss frustrated at hospital handover delay. This story is brought to you by Kerry Ashdown. Ambulances continue to be stuck outside hospitals for hours, keeping them off the roads for emergencies. West Midlands Ambulance Service has revealed it is facing the worst level of hospital handover delays in the country. In October alone, ambulance crews lost 41,000 hours waiting outside hospitals across the region to transfer patients, Staffordshire County councillors have been told, and the number of lost hours has more than doubled in recent months. In November 2023, the service called for an independent review of resources in a bid to improve its performance. Members of Staffordshire County Council's Health and Care Overview and Scrutiny Committee backed this call at the time, and a fresh review plea was made by senior members of the service at Monday's committee meeting. 2 years ago, the committee heard that two services covering the region was failing to meet response time targets. Since then, improvements have been seen, but hospital handover delays are having an impact on ambulance services, the West Midlands Ambulance Service has said. The main target was responsible for achieving its Category 2 response times. That represented about two-thirds of our workloads, and Category 2 calls are things like strokes and heart attacks. Last year we got under the 30-minute threshold and we delivered 29 minutes and some seconds. I'm pleased to say that to the committee we've managed to sustain that this year and improved it since. The target has been given by NHS England is for us to deliver 28 minutes. At the minute we're at 23 minutes this year to date. However, that's under some pressure as the time we have now been given is beginning to erode as we get into winter. 3 months ago, it was 21 minutes and we've been losing minutes on our year-to-date performance every month. The amount of time ambulances are spending at hospitals is rising. WMAS has been experiencing a steep month. Mr. Cashew told councillors he said in October it was 41,000, the month before it was 31 and the month before that it was 20. It's quite a difficult period, not just in terms of performance, but what that means to patients and to our staff. Whilst we may still be getting to patients in a reasonable time frame, most of that time that doesn't help the patient stuck in an ambulance for 5, 10 or 15 hours outside the hospital, maybe being moved around 4 times between ambulances outside the hospital. It's not a good experience at all for them. We've put in, over the last 18 months, what amounts to £30 million additional frontline resources to offset the time that ambulances are spent at hospitals. It's the only thing that we can realistically do that's in our control. Mr. Cashew added the NHS is in its planning guidance mandated hospitals to deliver a maximum handover wait for 45 minutes. That it's not occurring here or anywhere in the West Midlands, perhaps with the exception of South Warwickshire. Free liver health checks offered by alcohol team. Eligible patients in Sandwell and West Birmingham are now able to refer themselves for a scan checking the health of their liver. A FibroScan is a type of ultrasound that measures the amount of inflammation in the liver. It can detect scarring, otherwise known as fibrosis or cirrhosis, which can occur as a result of heavy drinking. The scans are being offered by Sandwell and West Birmingham's NHS Trust Alcohol Care Team, who have won numerous awards for their innovative care of patients with alcohol use disorders. Quick and non-invasive, the scans can lead to faster diagnosis and improved treatment of liver damage and liver cancer. The Alcohol Care Team has a dedicated FibroScan nurse who can be employed by the Trust since 2023. Since then, 1,200 people have been scanned, with 14% found to have liver cirrhosis and 16% having signs of fibrosis. Initially, only patients who came into hospital with symptoms of liver damage were referred to the gastroenterology department for a scan. The Alcohol Care Team has now expanded their FibroScan service to give residents who regularly drink over recommended limits the option of completing a self-referral for a scan. garage commemorating 65 years of family history and community spirit. This story is brought to you by Beverly Raidmaker. A family-owned Smethwick garage with a truckload of history is celebrating its 65th anniversary this month. Bayliss Garages Limited will be celebrating the milestone on November the 28th, marking 65 years since the business became a limited company in 1960. Its roots, however, go back even further. The Bayliss family journey in business began in the 1930s with Charles Henry Bayliss Sr.'s C.H. Bayliss Coal Merchants, which later transitioned into C.H. Bayliss Transport and Haulage. The garage itself in Sydney Road, Bearwood, was brought into 1960 from the Thorston family, who had operated as a garage on the same site since 1913. For Charles Bayliss Sr., son John and Charles Jr. to work there, meanwhile, his daughter Doris became the bookkeeper for the haulage firm and the garage. Today, it continues to be a family affair. Peter Bayliss, grandson of Charles Bayliss Sr., is at the helm as managing director, whilst Peter's daughter Charlotte, who's 26, is the service advisor. Meanwhile, his wife Lisa is co-director and son Jack also helps out for a time, helping to bring the business into the digital age. Peter, who used to live in the house next door to the garage as a child along with his family, said things have not really changed much in the area. In fact, the street structure of the garage that was built in 1927 by Elwell Buildings remains in place today behind the brick frontage. He told the Express and Star, "We still have a business here. We've been MOT testers since they started in 1960 for cars, motorbikes, and we are well known for that. But cars have changed and there's more electrics to deal with now, and we can service electrics and hybrid cars." To mark the big milestone, a blue sapphire anniversary, the garage, which employs 7 members of staff, including hoster Terry Stillman, a member of the Lotus Club, who brought along a vintage silver Lotus 7 Series 1 Climax on November the 2nd. The rare model harks back to when Charles Henry Bayliss Jr. first acquired the business in 1960, and a celebratory snap was taken which features the original wooden garage, members of the Bayliss family, and Charles Bayliss Jr.'s red Lotus 7 Series 1 Climax that he's owned at the time. Peter said that seeing the vintage sports car brought tears to the eyes of his Aunt Pauline, Charles Jr. widow, who was amongst the family members attending the celebration. The celebration was enjoyed with coffee, cake and a glass of fizz. Peter said that he was very proud to be steering the business forward and keeping the family's legacy alive, especially as he's not a mechanic by trade. In fact, he spent 32 years working for the NHS in mental services in Bromsgrove and Redditch before taking over the running of Bayliss Garages in 2016 after his dad retired. Reflecting on the company's longevity and the anniversary celebration, he said, "I'm very proud, especially when I had all my family there. It's hard to put into words. I'm proud to be a third generation owner. I love the fact that my grandfather's business is lasting that little bit longer. It's good to keep it going. I believe that we're the oldest family business with the same building in the area. It's quite unique," Peter added. Another slice of history the Bayliss family enjoying reminiscing about is the business once employed Pat Roach, a professional wrestler who then turned his hand to acting, becoming a UK household name in the 1980s through his role as Bomber as the TV comedy drama Our Feeder's Own Pet. He later went on to star in the Indiana Jones movie. Peter, who lives in Bromsgrove, recalls how in 2002 he went to a book signing in his hometown to see if he could see Pat, and had the pleasure of meeting him and posing for a picture which appeared in the local newspaper. The actor and wrestler briefly worked in the family's coal business as a coalman before fame beckoned, a detail he shared in his book If, and the Bayliss family keep in touch with him until his death in Bromsgrove in 2004 at the age of 67. Beyond its automotive services, Bayliss Garages likes to get involved with the local community in Smethwick, proudly sponsoring Wally Woods Party in the Park and Santa in the Woods events. And as part of the Christmas festivities, the garage will be generously offering a full service as a raffle prize. The sponsorship of the event began as a way of honouring Peter's late father John, who died in 2023. Peter added, "Wally Woods is very close to the garage and it's nice to sponsor something that the local community can enjoy." On this day, November the 12th, 1035, death of Canute, Danish King of England. 1660, John Bunyan, author of The Pilgrim's Progress, was jailed for preaching without a license. 1840, sculptor Auguste Rodin was born in Paris. 1859, the man who invented the leotard, Jules Leotard, gave the world's first flying trapeze display in Paris. 1911, the Reverend Chad Varra, founder of the Samaritans, was born. 1919, the first flight from England to Australia began from Hounslow with Ross and Keith Smith in a Vickers Vimy. They landed safely on December the 10th. 1931, Abbey Road Recording Studios in London was opened by Sir Edgar Elgar. 1944, Tirpitz, last of Hitler's fleet of unsinkable battleships, was sunk off the Norwegian coast by Lancaster bombers. In 1979, in response to the hostage situation in Tehran, US President Jimmy Carter ordered a halt to all petroleum imports into the United States from Iran. 1919, Crown Prince Akihito, formally installed as Emperor Akihito of Japan, becomes the 125th Japanese monarch. 1997, Ramzi Youssef was found guilty of masterminding the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. 2018, American comic book writer Stan Lee, who helped create such iconic characters as Spider-Man and X-Men for Marvel Comics, dies at the age of 95. 2023, an evening dinner menu for the first class passengers on board the Titanic sells for more than £80,000 at auction.
This is Alison, recording a selection of articles Thursday from the Express and Star. Building Society is branching out to help combat loneliness. West Brom Building Society has joined forces with community initiative Talking Tables to help bring people together to combat loneliness and isolation in Tipton. The initiative, which is active in towns and cities across the country, partners with local businesses to host weekly one-hour Talking Tables, where anyone can drop by for a chat and connect with others. Each table is led by a volunteer who welcomes visitors and helps start conversations in a relaxed, friendly environment. The Talking Table at the West Brom's Tipton branch officially opened on Friday, November the 7th, with the Mayor of Sandwell and local councillor Steve Melia, Great Bar with Yew Tree Ward, and local councillor Richard Jeffcoat, Tipton Green Ward, attending a celebratory event alongside branch colleagues and members of the local community. Talking Table sessions will take place every Friday at the Tipton branch of West Brom Building Society in its recently launched community space. The community room is free to use and can be booked by local clubs, societies and individuals for events, meetings and gatherings. Harriet Yates, branch manager at the West Brom's Tipton branch, said, "We're delighted to welcome Talking Tables into our community space. It's a fantastic initiative that encourages connection and companionship, and we're proud to support something that makes such a positive difference in people's lives. Our community space was designed to bring local people together, whether that's through coffee mornings, baby groups, or initiatives like Talking Tables. And this partnership is a perfect example of how we can use it to strengthen community spirit right here in Tipton." The Talking Table sessions will be hosted by volunteer Diana Thomas Smout, who will act as table leader each week. Diana said, "Sometimes all it takes is a friendly conversation to brighten someone's day. I'm really looking forward to welcoming people along to the Talking Table at the West Brom and helping to create a space where everyone feels seen, heard and included." Talking Table sessions will take place every Friday from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. at the West Brom's Tipton Branch Community Space. For more information about Talking Tables, visit Talking Tables, that's T-A-L-K-I-N, tables.co.uk. Doctors and authority staff poised to stage walkouts. Strike action around pay and conditions is set to affect hospitals and GP surgeries across the region. There is set to be several days of disruption after resident doctors in England rejected a fresh offer from the government to end the long-running row over jobs and pay, saying that it does not go far enough. The medics, formerly known as junior doctors, are set to strike for 5 days from 7 a.m. tomorrow until 7 a.m. on November the 19th. The British Medical Association, or BMA, said the resident doctor strike is a result of a dispute over two issues. The first is pay, with the BMA arguing that resident doctors have experienced a real terms pay cut of 21% since 2008-09, due to pay awards given to resident doctors over that time being below inflation. The BMA is now calling for pay restoration for resident doctors, with a demand of a 26% pay rise. The second issue relates to training places for resident doctors. Hospitals which will be affected by the strike action include Midland Metropolitan Hospital in Smethwick, Walsall Manor Hospital, New Cross Hospital, Rowley Regis Hospital, Heartlands Hospital, Russell's Hall Hospital and Cannock Chase Hospital. Meanwhile, staff from the West Midlands Combined Authority will also strike tomorrow over an inadequate pay offer. Unison confirmed that workers involved in various roles across the region will walk out after overwhelmingly rejecting a 3.2% offer. Their pay rise for 2025 to 2026 was due more than 6 months ago. Hundreds expected to honour athletics club stalwart Keith. Hundreds of people from the Tipton community were expected to come out today to honour a stalwart of the town's famous athletics club. Keith Rollison, known as the Tipton Thrasher or Killer Keith, will be remembered at his funeral, followed by a wake at the venue which is the home of the famous Tipton Harriers Athletics Club. So much a part of the club during the 1970s and 1980s, when he was an international cross-country champion, Keith will be wearing the famous vest of green and white hoops as he makes his final journey. His nephew, Jimmy Andrews, whose dad Robert trained Keith and the likes of Paul Venmore, who was equally successful in the sport, said the family would like the whole community to come out and celebrate his life. He said, "Keith, Paul and many others of their time showed true dedication, grit and passion to a sport they all were committed in and invested in like professionals. And as successful as they were, behind the scenes they built a legacy that's still remembered by those who followed athletics in its heyday across the Black Country and beyond. Keith was a record breaker, a champion through and through, and carried that same strength and grit throughout his life. Even in his later years, after being diagnosed with prostate cancer, he would laugh it off and simply say that the only thing wrong with him was that he needed a new knee. That was Keith all over, tough, humble, and never want to surrender or give up. He passed away recently at the grand age of 75, and fittingly, he's going to be wearing his Tipton Harriers vest for his final outfit, a proud symbol of his lifelong passion," added Mr. Andrews. The funeral was taking place at 12:15 p.m. today at Gornal Woods Crematorium, followed by a wake at his beloved Tipton Sports and Social Club. Man jailed after threatening to stab up staff in shoplifting spree. A West Bromwich man who threatened staff when going on a shoplifting spree at stores around the Black Country has been jailed. Hopeton Falconer, aged 58, carried out 18 shoplifting offences between November 2024 and June 2025, Wolverhampton Crown Court heard. Often, he would take random items, not usually of large value, including from Farm Foods Smethwick, when he took £60 worth of meat and dishwasher tablets and made his escape on a push bike, abusing security staff who tried to stop him. On January 15, 2025, Falconer of Polar Grove, West Bromwich, stole items from the Co-op in Tipton, and when challenged outside by security staff, again became abusive, threatening them with the broken neck of a wine bottle which he clenched in his hand, saying, "I'll stab you up." A victim impact statement from one of the staff affected was read out to the court and told of the trauma they had faced in the incident. The court heard Falconer, who had 42 previous theft-related convictions, had already pleaded guilty to 18 offences and one of possession of a Class A drug, namely crack cocaine, and had made good progress in prison. but jailing him for a total of 35 weeks, recorder William Ellis said, in each of the shoplifting cases, he had produced a significant threat or even use of force, often using random objects, which had caused the people they were aimed at significant distress and fear. Poor lights led to bus tragedy. Poor street lighting contributed to the death of a 4-year-old boy who was struck by a bus, a coroner has ruled. Black Country senior coroner, Mr. Zafar Sadiq, called for improvements to lighting on a street in Tipton where Gurkirat Singh died. An inquest was told he was struck by bus in a dark street and died as a result of head and chest injuries. Gurkirat was on his way from a shopping trip with his mother and siblings when he crossed the road from between parked cars into the path of the 226 in Tipton High Street, shortly before 5 p.m. on December the 6th last year. Giving evidence at the hearing in Oldbury, bus driver Ahebi Nikase said in the darkness he did not see the child crossing from the right-hand side of the street. He explained moments before the collision, he pulled up at the bus stop and one passenger alighted. He checked the mirrors and indicated to pull out before pulling out. Mr. Nikase, who apologised to the family at the hearing, said, "The first thing I saw was a flash in front of me. Then the bus jolted, and that's when I realised something was wrong. It happened fast. I didn't see anyone. I braked hard, but it was too late." West Midlands Police civilian forensic collision investigator Jake Bartlett told the inquest the bus was only travelling at 19 miles per hour. He said, "The street is darker on the driver's right side than the other side. The streetlights there are more spaced out than the other side where the houses are." Mr. Sadiq gave the cause of death as head and chest injuries due to collision with a bus. He said he would be writing to Sandwell Council to recommend improvements to lighting in the vicinity, road markings and road safety measures as part of a prevention of future deaths report. And he inquired whether there had been other incidents on that stretch of road.
This is Lauren with some stories from the Express and Star from the 14th of November. Teenager is charged over knife possession. A 16-year-old boy has been charged with possessing a knife and attempted burglary in Sandwell. The teenager is accused of possession of a knife in a public place, attempted burglary and possession of cannabis after being stopped in the Rowley Regis area of Sandwell. West Midlands Police were called over reports of a member of the public being threatened with a weapon and attempts being made to access an address in Royal Oak Road, Rowley Regis, on Sunday, December 9th. Following inquiries in the region, officers detained a 16-year-old boy in connection with the incident. Following the arrest, the boy was charged with possession of a knife in a public place, attempted aggravated burglary, and possession of cannabis. He was remanded to appear before Wolverhampton Magistrates Court yesterday. A force spokesperson said, "We continually work with partners to warn young people of the dangers of carrying a knife. Everyone, including teachers, parents and carers, all have a part to play in reducing knife crime. Officers have appealed for anyone with any information on knife crime to contact them via the live chat section of the West Midlands Police website or by calling them on their 101 number." IKEA meatballs being delivered directly to homes. IKEA Birmingham is bringing its iconic Swedish delicacies even closer to home with the launch of an exciting new pilot food delivery and click and collect service. Customers can now enjoy approximately 80% of IKEA's Swedish food market range, including its famous meatballs, pantry staples and frozen favourites, delivered directly to their door or available for click and collect at the IKEA Birmingham store. As an introductory bonus, all orders qualify for free delivery with a minimum order spend of £15, and IKEA family members who also use the service will receive a £10 off £60 voucher to spend on home furnishing accessories, adding even more value to their order. The range available within the new service will enable customers to recreate their favourite IKEA dishes at home. frozen options including meatballs, plant balls and mashed potatoes, gravy and lingonberry sauce make it easy to replicate the iconic Swedish dining experience yourself. Pantry staples like crisp breads and IKEA's rich, flavourful coffee are perfect for stopping up, while sweet treats such as Dame Cake, cinnamon buns and Swedish cheesecake bring a little Scandinavian indulgence to your day. Customers can access the service by opening the IKEA app. Man tried to launch firework from bottom. Shocking footage has shown the moment a man suffered burns after trying to launch a firework from his bottom. A laughing friend ignites the firework using a lighter in the middle of the street, but rather than it taking off, the projectile explodes on the spot, causing nasty burns to the victim's backside. Instead of rushing to his aid, onlookers can be heard laughing in hysterics. The footage, obtained by Berms is Grime, is believed to have been filmed in the Birmingham area over the weekend. The Royal Society for the Prevention of Accidents, ROSPA, revealed ahead of Bonfire Night last week that firework-related accidents had risen by 42%. Latest figures from the Home Office said 246 such incidents occurred in 2024-25, up from 185 in the previous year. ROSPA said the stats highlighted a worrying trend in unsafe firework use, and human error remained the primary factor in more than 75% of incidents. Rebecca Guy said, "Only adults should handle them and never mix alcohol with lighting fireworks. The shocking rise in incidents over the past year is a stark reminder of the dangers they pose when misused." Traditional lollipop patrols to be replaced with zebras. Written by Christian Barnett, local Democracy reporter. A number of school lollipop patrols near schools are to disappear and will be replaced with permanent zebra crossings. Sandor Council plans to scrap 5 vacant school crossing positions and replace them with the fixed crossings in a bid to save money. The plan, which forms part of the Labour-run authority's budget proposals for the coming year, would save £25,000 a year from its revenue day-to-day budget. The council said there were 9 school crossing patrol vacancies, with 2 vacant for more than 18 months. Several positions have not been filled for more than a year. The location of the 5 new replacement crossings has not been confirmed by the council, but would be those best served by a permanent crossing, it said. Council tax and the cost of garden waste collections are set to rise in Sandwell next year to cover a £17 million hole in the council's budget. The council plans to make more than £8 million worth of cuts and savings, as well as tap into just over £9 million from its reserves to cover the shortfall in its finances for 2026-27. The budget proposal said, "Due to ongoing vacancies and recruitment challenges in the school crossing patrol service, it is proposed for 2026-27 to replace 5 unfilled patrol positions with capital-funded formal pedestrian crossings, offering safe, all-day community access, whilst generating year-on-year revenue efficiencies and making use of annual grants for permanent road safety improvements." Councillor Keith Alcock, Cabinet Member for Environment and Highways at Sandor Council, added, "Road safety is our highest priority and we are seeking the best way to achieve this. Over the past 20 years, Sandwell has halved the number of casualties on its road, including reducing child casualties by 67%. This big reduction follows a targeted programme of engineering and education measures and supporting police enforcement action work, which will continue to keep improving safety. Unfortunately, we have had several of our valued lollipop positions vacant for a while due to unfilled positions. We want to find permanent solutions to allow parents to have confidence that children can cross our roads safely. These new crossings will also be there all day, every day, providing a welcome road safety improvement that benefits the whole community. This is part of our rollout of plans to make our roads even safer. Our Phase 1 Community Road Safety Concern programme is being designed now, with the first of 38 projects starting in January. The move was discussed by the Council's Budget Scrutiny Committee, Alan Lunt. The council's director for place told councillors, "It is difficult to recruit. Replacing a vacant post with a physical school crossing ensures the safety for children crossing the road, and ultimately, it does generate an efficiency. Alongside this article is a picture of a lollipop lady. However, this appears to be a lollipop man, which I don't know why I've acted so surprised at that. So it's a picture of a road with cars parked on the edges and a bus stop in the distance. The lollipop man is stood in the centre of the road wearing a long yellow high-vis coat with a yellow cap, his arms spread out, holding a yellow sign that says stop in the shape of a lollipop. It's a circle on top of a stick. In front of him is a mother crossing with a baby attached to her chest. In a carrier, she is pushing a pram with another child in and a younger child walking alongside next to her. It's captioned, "School crossing patrol officers with their lollipops to be replaced with crossings."
Hello, this is Sarbjit with your news from the Express and Star. Saturday, the 15th of November. Home and garden retailer opens store. A leading UK home retailer has opened a new store, welcoming eager shoppers with giveaways and a new shopping experience. The grand opening yesterday kicked off with a ribbon-cutting ceremony, marking the debut of The Range Superstore in Aldbury, but also the brand new store highlight, Garden Centre by Homebase. The Garden Centre by Homebase is described as a paradise for green-fingered enthusiasts, offering everything from outdoor plants and gardening tools to essential supplies, and the new hub transforms the store into a one-stop destination for all home and garden improvements. Crowds gathered early to be among the first through the doors, with the first 50 customers receiving a goodie bag packed with top products. Even more prizes were up for grabs, including the Black & Decker combi drill and cordless mouse sander, while shoppers were also treated to expert tips and demos from brand representatives, including Westlands, who were on hand to showcase the latest products. Chief Executive of CDS Superstores, trading as The Range, Wilko and Homebase, Alex Sipkin, said, "We're thrilled to have welcomed so many people to our new Aldbury location, following the acquisition of Homebase. It was amazing to see the community come together to celebrate, and we're proud to offer such a fantastic range of products and prizes to thank them for their support. With the launch of the new Garden Centre by Homebase, shoppers can now find everything from plants and outdoor living solutions to stylish homeware from The Range, pet products and everyday essentials, all under one roof." Deal or no deal? Six Baggies Aces set to be out of contract, by Johnny Drury. There is a picture of striker Josh Meyer playing football, who has not hit the heights of his pre-injury form last season. A host of senior players have left Albion in recent summers when their contracts at the club have expired. Long-serving players have departed, with the club's owners working to bring down the average age of the squad and the wage bill. The current season may only be a few months old, but there will be players looking towards the next summer and thinking where their futures may be, with their contracts set to run out. Six Albion first team players are out of contract next summer. Here, we look at the chances of them being handed a new deal. Josh Meyer. Meyer's time at Albion has had some big ups and some big downs. From the two injuries in his first campaign to that blistering form last season where he looked as though he would not stop scoring. But although the goals were memorable, his injury record is what he might just be remembered for. He returned recently, having been out since the new year, but despite a goal on his return against Norwich, he hasn't looked like hitting the heights of that spell last season. Whether it is match sharpness or something else, he doesn't seem the same player at the moment. If he can hit his straps like we know he can, then Meyer can be one of the most potent strikers in the division. If he does rediscover his form, though, he will be a quality striker potentially available on a free in the summer. Verdict? Maybe. Carlin Grant. Long-serving Grant's lengthy deal he signed in the last Premier League campaign is up in the summer. Grant has divided opinion among some during his time at the club. After relegation, he bagged 18 goals. He racked up plenty of appearances either side of a loan move to Cardiff, and last season was one of Albion's better performers during early parts of the campaign. He has had his worth for Albion managers and has recently been praised by Ryan Mason for what he brings to the squad. However, it may just be a time where Grant is moved on in the summer after 6 years with the club. Verdict? No deal. Jed Wallace. Signed on a free, the club captain was a regular during his first two seasons at Albion, netting 6 goals in both campaigns. Since then, his game time has diminished, much of it coming as a substitute. I think most fans hail the hard work and leadership Wallace has brought to Albion during his time at the club. But given his limited role and a few issues with injury, it is unlikely he remains beyond this season. Verdict? No deal. Usman Diakite. An interesting one that will cause debate among fans. Diakite is only just starting to get his first real run of starts in the side, having joined on a free last summer. He has been restricted to mainly substitute appearances up to now. Diakite has brought his physical qualities to the Albion side, breaking up play and showing he does have value. But has he done enough to land a new deal? I think on this one it depends what happens between now and the end of the season. Verdict? Maybe. Joe Wildsmith. The Baggies number 2 had a spell in the side after the departure of Alex Palmer, but a handful of costly errors saw him replaced by Josh Griffiths. Either side of that, he has been the understudy and has been praised in that role. Given how his time at Albion has gone and the talented young goalkeepers coming through the ranks, it looks unlikely he stays on. Verdict? No deal. Daryl Dyke. Dyke's injury woes are well documented. He has spent more time out than he has fit at Albion, but when he has been fit and firing, he has shown just what he can do. That spell back in 2022 and into 2023 was arguably his best, when he racked up the goals only to be cut down with injury yet again. There is frustration around Dyke and a will for him to return and have a run of games. But this season, despite getting back onto the bench in recent weeks, it hasn't happened. Verdict? No deal. All change on the buses while work gets into gear at Junction. By Deborah Hardiman, Chief Reporter. There is a picture of a bus travelling along Burnt Tree Junction, picture courtesy of Transport for West Midlands. West Bromwich bus passengers are facing changes to routes while major improvements are carried out at Dudley's Burnt Tree Junction. Bus operator National Express West Midlands has rolled out details of the changes which will kick into gear from tomorrow. To minimise delays for those travelling from Dudley, West Bromwich, Oldbury and Great Bridge, there will be some changes to services 74, 87 and 126. The project is part of a larger scheme to improve the operation of the junction and will include the creation of new crossing points to improve safety for pedestrians and cyclists. During the works, traffic restrictions will be in place, including temporary traffic signals and lane restrictions in both directions. Service 74. Daytime journeys will be split between Birmingham and Great Bridge and then West Bromwich and Dudley. Customers travelling between Dudley and Great Bridge to between West Bromwich and Birmingham will need to change buses at either Great Bridge or West Bromwich. Due to this split, a transfer ticket will be introduced on this service only. This ticket will allow customers boarding on the 74 to change at either Great Bridge or West Bromwich to complete their regular journey without having to pay twice. Services will run up to every 15 minutes between Great Bridge and Dudley and up to every 5 minutes between West Bromwich and Birmingham. There will be one journey every 7 minutes between West Bromwich and Great Bridge. Early morning and evening journeys will continue to run from Birmingham to Dudley. Service 87. There will be timetable changes to add extra time to journeys to help cover delays due to the highway works. Service 126. There will be timetable changes to add extra time to journeys between Causeway Green and Dudley to help cover delays due to the highway works. There will be a route change whereby buses will use Regent Road, Oakham Road, Dixon's Green Road, Hall Street, Trindle Road and Castle Hill in both directions. It will be the largest road scheme on the junction since the former traffic island was removed in a scheme which ran from 2008 to 2011. Commuters have been warned they face possible delays for up to 9 months on the busy route through the Black Country. "The chips are the same colour as my jumper," says Johnny Rotten. There is a picture of John Lydon, who is wearing an orange jumper, trying some orange chips. Major's Fish and Chips on Church Street, Bilston, has gained its latest celebrity fan, one whose jumper is as orange as the chips themselves. Punk icon and the Sex Pistols legend, John Lydon, better known as Johnny Rotten, was spotted tucking into a bag of Major's iconic orange chips following his sold-out gig at Bilston's Robin 2. The London-born singer, songwriter and author reportedly sent out for a bag of chips after being told that they were the best in the world by Robin 2 venue boss Fraser Turner. Talking about the chips, Mr. Lydon said that he's never seen anything like them, adding that while they're delicious, he didn't think it was possible to make fish and chips any more unhealthy. The punk icon said, "The chips are the same colour as my jumper, orange. I've never seen anything like them. They're delicious. I didn't think it was possible to make fish and chips even more unhealthy, but Bilston has found a way." Lydon visited Wolverhampton as part of his I Could Be Wrong, I Could Be Right UK tour, where he discusses his extraordinary career. He will be back in Wolverhampton on December 29, where his band, Public Image Limited, will headline a special Wolfram Hall show. 1 month's rain in a single day, by James Vukmirovic. There is a picture of Debbie Gittins and her daughter Sadie Bissett, who braved the weather in Bewdley with their umbrellas. Storm Claudia dumped almost a month's rain on the West Midlands in just one day. And while the weekend promises to be drier, there are concerns that river levels will continue to rise. Flood defences have gone up along the River Severn, with new barriers in part of Bewdley being tested for the first time. River levels aren't expected to peak for a couple of days as water makes its way downstream. Other towns along the river, including Bridge North, Ironbridge and Shrewsbury, are also on alert. Around half an inch of rain has fallen in some parts of the West Midlands in the last 24 hours, with exposed areas on higher ground the worst hit. An amber warning for persistent and heavy rain came into force yesterday and ran until the early hours of today. Several roads in the Black Country were closed off because of standing water, while rail services were left disrupted due to rails becoming underwater and winds causing issues with overhead lines. Strong easterly winds made it feel unpleasant for pedestrians, and some areas even experienced thunder. Severn Trent says it has engineers out ensuring drainage is clear in areas where there has been localised flooding. Storm Claudia, named by the Spanish Meteorological Agency, has already brought heavy rain and strong winds to Spain and Portugal. Met Office Chief Meteorologist Matthew Leonard said, "Storm Claudia has brought very heavy rainfall to a large swathe of central and southern England and Wales on Friday into Saturday. This rain has been slow moving, and some areas could see up to a month's worth of rain in 24 hours. Some exposed areas of the Midlands have experienced power cuts due to the weather, with 200 homes at Craven Arms near Bridgnorth hit, along with around 50 properties in Telford and others in Newport near Stafford."
Hello, this is Jenny. I hope you're all managing to keep warm. It's very cold out there at the moment. The following articles are from the Express and Star newspaper, Monday, November the 17th. Food Bank Delight as Building Society lends substantial support. An article by James Vikmirovich. A food bank working to help people in need across the Black Country has received a substantial funding boost. Black Country Food Bank has welcomed a £12,000 contribution from the Tipton and Coseley Building Society ahead of one of its busiest times of the year. Members of the society presented the donation during a visit to the food bank's Briley Hill warehouse. The Tipton has been supporting Black Country Food Bank since 2023, pledging annual donations and providing teams of volunteers to help sort, check and label food items. In total, the Society has given £36,000 over 3 years and introduced food collection points into each of its four branches. Black Country Food Bank was founded in 2006 with a mission to feed local people in crisis, enabling them to access food and other essentials while they get back on their feet. Based in Briley Hill, it has 28 distribution centres across Dudley, Sandwell and Walsall. Jen Coleman, Chief Executive at Black Country Food Bank, said, "Financial donations are crucial to us. They mean we can replenish supplies, keep our vehicles running, heat and light our premises and look after our volunteers. Receiving regular payments, such as those kindly provided by the Tipton, also helps us budget and plan for the future. This is particularly important as we approach winter, which brings its own set of challenges like higher energy bills. Many individuals and families struggle to afford even basic necessities, placing considerable demand on our food banks and resources." Adam Evitts, the Tipton's chief executive, said, "Black Country Food Bank is a lifeline for those who can't buy the food they need every week. We are proud to support the incredible work the food bank does. We also value the opportunity to spend time volunteering with the charity, learning more about their services and seeing for ourselves how our donations make a difference." Hedgehog Hero 82 is honoured with a British Empire Medal. An article by Paul Jenkins. A Staffordshire wildlife stalwart has been awarded a British Empire Medal, BEM, for her decades of work in rescuing and caring for hedgehogs. Joan Lockley received her medal in a ceremony at Birmingham Council House in recognition of her 25 years caring for hedgehogs at her home in Cheslin Hay, during which she has always preached the same advice to anyone who may come across one of the creatures in the daytime. that they are in trouble. This year alone, she has taken in just under 800 hedgehogs at her Staffordshire home and headquarters of the West Midlands Hedgehog Rescue, feeding and nursing them until they are fit to be released. News of her award came last December. Joan, a sprightly 82, also hosts an open day every year, working tirelessly to put on a fundraiser where the community can enjoy live music, stalls, food and games, and has raised thousands of pounds to help with her work. Just last week, in the stormy weather on Friday, she took in two hedgehogs, and her telephone is always on for people who need help or advice if they see one. She said, "There are very few, if any, dedicated hedgehog sanctuaries left, at least in the West Midlands, and I say the same to everyone who telephones me or sees one at the side of the road. If it is out during the day, it is in trouble. I never turn a hedgehog away. Up to 900 a year come through my doors or garden, and I get calls at all times of the day and night. But I always say the same thing. Don't take it in yourself. Bring it to me, as I have the facilities here and the knowledge after 25 years to look after them. It really is a labour of love." Joan said she didn't seek recognition, but it was nice to receive the BEM. She said, "When the envelope came, I thought, ooh, what have I done wrong? But it was such an honour and a nice day out when I received the medal." On her future plans, she said, "It's too late to retire, although people ask me about it." Improvements to West Midlands ring and ride services are welcomed. Measures to improve the West Midlands ring and ride service have been backed and described as a long time coming. Members of the West Midlands Combined Authorities, WMCA, Transport Delivery Overview and Scrutiny Committee were presented with a raft of changes to be implemented to the service. A group was set up to identify and tackle issues and ensure it is more financially viable. A report to the committee set out a number of measures aimed at providing a more simplified service model and improve fairness, efficiency and within a balanced budget. Earlier this year, increases to the ring and ride fares were agreed by WMCA board with the Walsall Council leader saying the cost of each trip amounting to £26 per head was not acceptable. Among the latest measures put forward are changing current boundaries and adopting a distance cap of 4 miles. Another change would include deploying a mixed-size fleet, specifically using a smaller 8-seater, while also trialling other smaller vehicles. Another move would reduce the booking window from 7 days to 3 days on a trial basis to see if the impact on cancellation rates and passenger no-shows was also put forward. They will also adopt a maximum of 14 trips per customer, 7 return trips, as well as exploring a trial of group trips to test take-up. Wolverhampton councillor and committee member Carol Hyatt backed the measures and said she was very pleased with the trial of grouped bookings, something she had been suggesting for years. She said, "This has been a long time coming and is very much needed. This report reflects how we can best meet the needs of our most vulnerable residents." Intrinsically connected to the community, ENS lands award. An article by Beverly Rademacher, business editor. The Express and Star has been named Newspaper of the Year at the prestigious Midlands Media Awards. It won the flagship award at the gala dinner held at the Burlington Hotel in Birmingham. The awards, presented by former Central News journalists Bob Warman and Luella Bailey, attracted hundreds of entries from across the wider West and East Midlands region. The Express and Star beat its sister title, the Shropshire Star, and the Birmingham Mail, who were also shortlisted for the main prize. It was a good night for the Express and Star, with Adam Smith winning News Reporter of the Year and Tim Thursfield named News Photographer of the Year. The Georgies described Adam as having a depth of knowledge enabling him to look beyond what is in front of him. He writes with the public's interest in mind. On Tim, they said he has a great eye for summing up in one, press photo opportunities. It's probably not possible for him to take anything less than a first-class image. The awards, organised by Birmingham Press Club, celebrate journalism in print and broadcasting, as well as public relations. It also included several awards for students who are learning their craft at universities across the region. Ms. Bailey said the judges had spent hours sifting through the entries, adding, "I must say that the standard of work displayed by every one of them has been simply outstanding." The Express and Star entry highlighted its tireless drive to promote the West Midlands and the people who live here. The newspaper has launched campaigns to highlight a scourge of knife crime, calling for tighter laws. We have also run a Backingow Breweries campaign in the wake of the closure of Banks's plant in Wolverhampton. And we continue to highlight the financial plight of hospices through our Fair Deal for Hospices campaign. The printed paper continues to be among the most read in the UK, and our online coverage on expressandstar.com continues to develop, with a growing number of people signing up to our Premium Plus service. The judges said the Express and Star was a publication that continues to be intrinsically connected to the community it serves, retaining its relevance in the digital age. Express and Star editor Mark Drew said, "I'm delighted to have won the award. It is a reward to our incredibly hard-working team for their expertise and dedication to provide the very best coverage in news, sport and features. They continue to go over and above the make of the newspaper and website the best it can be. Our role is to stand up for this region and the wonderful people who live here, and I hope we have shown that we can make a real difference. We will continue to fight for causes that are important for the West Midlands." A letter from Daryl Magher in the Midlands. Bring back the partnership. Samwell Council once promised its nature reserves and parks friends groups a genuine partnership, quarterly meetings, published minutes and an annual programme of works. These promises have not been kept. The last recorded meetings were in March 2024 and the council has since fallen silent. Our local volunteers continue to work tirelessly to keep parks safe, clean and welcoming, but without information or support from the authority that should be leading by example. A partnership without communication is not a partnership at all. If Samwell Council values its volunteers, it must restore open meetings, publish the missing minutes, and be transparent about what it is delivering in our green spaces.
Hi, this is Kate, and I'm reading you some articles from the Express and Star. The 18th of November, Freddie Mercury celebrated. Freddie Mercury has been celebrated with a new Royal Mint coin design, which the Queen's singer sister said would have meant the world to him. The coin design depicts the charismatic showman mid-performance accompanied by his signature. Details on the coin tell the story of Mercury's extraordinary talent through carefully crafted design elements, the Royal Mint have said. The singer's four-octave vocal range is represented by a musical stave that runs around the edge of the coin, spanning from bass to treble notes. A studded armband edge design draws inspiration from Freddie Mercury's Live Aid performance outfit. And Mercury's sister, Kashmira Bulsara, visited the Royal Mint to strike the first coin, saying it was an emotional moment. This article is supported by someone from the Royal Mint holding the coin in their hand. It's a big silver coin. As said in the article, there is a photograph of Freddie in his very famous yellow jacket, white trousers with a stripe up the side at Live Aid. And he's standing there with his leg out behind him and his head up to the sky with a microphone in his hand. Bullseye. Darts brings in millions. Huge economic boost and eyes of the world on city for international event. The Grand Slam of Darts has boosted the region's economy by around £3.4 million and has pushed its profile around the globe. The annual week of darts action in Wolverhampton has been celebrated by organisers and business owners as a showcase for the city and an event which gives the local economy a significant boost. The 2025 edition of the Grand Slam Darts brought tens of thousands of darts fans to Wolverhampton active Aldersley across 9 days of competition, featuring some of the best dart players in the world, with Luke Littler triumphant on the finals night. The fans came equipped for fun across the different sessions of play, with many dressing up in fancy dress, ranging from Arabian sheiks to minions, and the atmosphere inside the 2,000 capacity arena was vibrant and fun on the tables as well as in the stands. Figures by the Professional Darts Corporation, PDC, show the whole city benefits from the events as fans from across the country travel to watch the darts, with the economic benefit of the event adding up to around £3.4 million, with 1,000 extra tickets sold in 2025. The tournament is the leisure centre's main hall, was screened by Sky Sports around the world, with Wolverhampton now known as an established venue for the Grand Slam. PDC Chief Executive Matt Porter said, "The event had grown since Wolverhampton was picked as the host city in 2007. And the city was synonymous with the Grand Slam in the same way that the World Match Play was with Blackpool." He said that the worldwide TV exposure was a real benefit for the city, as well as the large crowds who went to the event and added to the local economy. He said the local crowd were really good in the strong darts region, but people are coming from further afield now as well, which is great. And from a TV perspective, there's coverage all around the world, so it showcases Wolverhampton. I think it's also really good for the local economy as people are coming and spending money in the city, staying over and going to the local bars and restaurants. And that's something which brings added value to the city as well as to us. And it's grown hugely. And this article is supported by a photograph of darts fanatic Dave Higgins from Shrewsbury at Alderley Leisure Village, and he's got a Hawaiian shirt on with a flower lei around his neck. He's got a pair of beer glasses, which are 2-pint glasses on either eye, and then he also has a pair of dartboard dealy boppers, so they're two big dartboards on a headband over his head. Nurse leader Melanie awarded the prestigious Queen's Nurse title. A mental health nurse in the Black Country has been awarded the prestigious Queen's Nurse QN title by the Queen's Nursing Institute QNI, recognising her outstanding leadership, compassion and dedication to improving care for some of the most vulnerable people in the community. The Queen's Nurse title is a nationally recognised mark of excellence awarded to nurses who demonstrate commitment to a high standards of practice, innovation and community care. Melanie Lamb, clinical lead for the high intensity use service at Black Country Healthcare, will celebrate her achievement at the QICN annual award ceremony in London, where she will be presented with her badge and certificate. Throughout her 20-year career in mental health nursing, Melanie has been driven by a deep passion for supporting vulnerable individuals through compassionate person-centred care. As clinical lead for the high-intensity use service, she spearheaded efforts to support individuals who frequently attend emergency and urgent care services, ensuring they receive the right care at the right time and in the right place. Under her leadership, the team has gained national recognition for its collaborative, compassionate and innovative approach, always striving to put people first. Melanie's work extends beyond the clinical leadership. She has cultivated strong partnerships across the city, improved health and wellbeing outcomes. One of the team's most notable collaborations is with the Walls Foundation through the Head for Health initiative, which uses the power of sport and community to promote mental wellbeing and offer hope to people facing difficult circumstances. This partnership exemplifies the team's ethos of creativity and compassion in finding new ways to support individuals holistically. Melanie said, "I'm incredibly honoured to be receiving the Queen's Nurse Award. I'm proud to be a mental health nurse and committed to supporting the communities of the Black Country. This achievement is not mine alone, and it reflects the dedication, compassion and the hard work of all my colleagues who support and inspire me every day in delivering patient care. I feel truly privileged to meet the individuals that I care for and to work alongside such talented and caring people." Carolyn Green, Chief Nursing Officer at Black Country Healthcare, said, "Our organisation is immensely proud of Melanie and her team. Her leadership, empathy and innovation approach truly embodies the spirit of nursing at its best. The Queen's Nurse Award is a fitting recognition of her unwavering commitment to improving lives." And this article is supported by a photograph of Melanie. Shopping Centre Festive Market. The festive season will be in full force across Merrihill Shopping Centre in December as it hosts its own Christmas market. The Merrihill Artisan Market begins on Monday, December the 1st, and will run for 21 days through the month. It will feature a number of traders selling gifts, local produce and a lot of other items, and will run from 11 a.m. till 8 p.m. throughout the month. The centre will also be open for longer, from November the 24th to December the 21st, opening from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. on weekdays and until 8 p.m. on Saturdays. Parasocial fans are the driving force behind UK Word of the Year. Cambridge Dictionary has revealed parasocial as its Word of the Year for 2025, defined as evolving a connection someone feels between themselves and a famous person they do not know. Psychologists have observed how the rise of one-sided parasocial relationships has redefined fandom and celebrity. For instance, when pop star Taylor Swift and American footballer Travis Kelce announced their engagement earlier this year, many fans felt a strong connection to them despite most not having ever met them. The parasocial relationship is people form with online influencers and artificial intelligence chatbots have also been highlighted as part of the growing trend. Colin McIntosh of the Cambridge Dictionary said, "Parasocial captures the 2025 zeitgeist. It's a great example of how language changes. What was once a specialist academic term has become mainstream. Millions of people are engaged in parasocial relationships. Many more are simply intrigued by their rise." The data reflects that the Cambridge Dictionary website is seeing spikes in lookups for parasocial. The language around parasocial phenomena is evolving fast as technology, society and culture shift and mutate. From celebrities to chatbots, parasocial trends are fascinating for those who are interested in the development of language. The term parasocial dates back to 1956 when two University of Chicago sociologists observed that television viewers engaged in parasocial relationships with stars. They noted how the rapidly expanding medium of television brought the faces of actors directly into viewers' homes, making them fixtures in people's lives. Simone Chenal, Professor of Experimental Social Psychology at the University of Cambridge, said parasocial was an inspired choice for a word of this year. "The rise of parasocial relationships has redefined fandom, celebrity, with AI, how ordinary people interact online," she said. "They've entered an age where many people from unhealthy and intense parasocial relationships with influencers. This leads to a sense that people know those they form parasocial bonds with, can trust them and can even lead to extreme forms of loyalty. Yet, it's completely one-sided. As trust in mainstream and traditional media breaks down, people turn to individual personalities or authorities, and when they spend many hours consuming their content, develop parasocial bonds, treating them more like close friends, family or cult leaders. When an influencer has so many followers, people assume that they are trustworthy."
TNS Soundings.
A quiz about capital cities now, with me, Roger Brooks. Question one. Which capital in Europe is the westernmost part of mainland Europe? Which capital city is the westernmost capital city in mainland Europe? Question two. More than 100 metres deep underground, you'd board a train there at Arsenalma Station. Arsenalma Station. In which capital city, often in the news these days, is that underground railway? Question 3. Which famous ancient European city has namesakes in 5 other continents? Question 4. Of which country is Santiago the capital? Question 5. Which capital city's name translates into good air? So in which country is a capital whose name translates into good air? Question 6. Washington, D.C. became the United States capital in 1800. Where was the capital before then? Where was the U.S. capital before 1800? And that is our 6 slick city questions. OK, how are you on capital cities? Roger here with the answers to our 6 slick cities. Which capital is the most western part of mainland Europe? Which capital? It is Lisbon in Portugal. Question 2. Arsenalna Station is part of an underground railway in which famous city? It is Kyiv, or Kiev, as we always used to call it, until it sadly became such a major part of the news. And that, of course, is in Ukraine. Question 3. Which famous ancient European city has namesakes in 5 continents? It's Rome, or Roma, as the Italians call it. The others are in Indonesia, Lesotho in Africa, Queensland in Australia, Texas in North America, and Ecuador in South America. Question 4. Which country's capital is Santiago? That is Chile. Question 5. Which capital city's name translates to good air? Well, it sounds like it. When you think about it, it's Buenos Aires. Question 6. Washington, D.C. became the U.S. capital in 1800. Before that, the capital was Philadelphia. Philadelphia. 6 teasers there about capital cities. Hope you enjoyed that.
TNS Soundings.
Some audio described TV programmes for the next week along with radio programme highlights from Talking News Federation. Search for publications TNF Soundings to hear these directly on their website.
TNF Soundings.
Hello, this is Diane welcoming you to your audio described TV programmes starting Saturday 22nd and ending Friday 29th of November, written by Christine. So starting with Saturday, Channel 4 kicks off with double helpings of each of the American sitcom favourites, Everybody Loves Raymond from 8, Frasier from 8.55 and The Simpsons from 9.55. Anita Rani meets Sheila Hancock in My Life at Christmas on BBC Two at 10 and on BBC One at 11.30 Dame Mary Berry is joined by Alex Jones for A Lifetime of Cooking. Meanwhile, on ITV, the documentary series Champions Full Gallop continues at 11.55. Your Saturday afternoon options start at 12 on BBC Two when the Great Food Guys are joined by Fenella and Kirsty from the Seafood Shack in Ullapool and athlete JJ Chalmers. That's followed at 12.30 by wildlife drama documentary My Life as a Turkey, which features biologist Joe Hutto, who raised 13 wild turkeys from eggs to the day they left home. There are 2 afternoon films on BBC One, The Gruffalo at 1, followed by The Gruffalo's Child at 1.25, and at 3.55, You Can Escape to the Country. Over on Channel 4, you have George Clark's Amazing Spaces at 2.25, followed by Kirsty and Phil's Love It or List It at 4.30, whilst on ITV, it's Bullseye at 4.25, followed by the Chase Celebrity Special at 6. The teams are racing to Honduras in Celebrity Race Across the World at 5.15 on BBC Two, and it's time for the Blackpool Tower Ballroom in Strictly at 6.35.
Your evening choices continue with ITV's Celebrity Catchphrase at 7, followed by the 1% Club at 8.05, with Channel 4 offering Bettany Hughes' Treasures of the World at 7, followed by New Zealand by Train at 8.05. At 9.05, you can choose between the continuing Wild Cherry series on BBC One and Hitler's DNA, Blueprint of a Dictator on Channel 4. Night owls might enjoy the 11 o'clock film option on Channel 4, Bad Boys for Life, an action comedy starring Will Smith and Martin Lawrence. On to Sunday. Channel 4 has two episodes of Everybody Loves Raymond from 8pm, followed by two helpings of Frasier from 9. Foodies can enjoy the final episode of Nadia's British Food Adventure at 11.30 and The Great Food Guys at 12, both on BBC Two. In the afternoon, you have BBC One's Blue Planet 2 at 2.05, followed by Kingdom at 2.15, whilst ITV's documentary series Fletcher's Family Farm is at 2.20. Shaun the Sheep, The Flight Before Christmas is at 3 on BBC One, followed by an afternoon film choice, Doolittle, at 3.35. Fern Britton is Inside the Vets at 3.20 on ITV, followed by another film choice, the musical comedy sequel Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again at 4.20. Sunday evening options start with sci-fi comedy sequel Men in Black 3 at 6 o'clock on Channel 4, Eva Longoria's Searching for Spain at 6.20 on BBC Two and Kingdom at 6.25 on BBC One. Top Gear is at 7 on BBC Two and Strictly Come Dancing The Results is at 7.15 on BBC One. At 8 you have Bullseye on ITV, Game of Wool, Britain's Best Knitter on Channel 4, or you could join Chris McCausland Seeing Into the Future on BBC Two, where the comedian and Strictly champion goes on a mission to discover the future of technology and what it might hold for him personally. Monica Galletti and Rob Rinder become staff for Sir Richard Branson at his Moroccan hotel in Amazing Hotels, Life Beyond the Lobby at 8.45 on BBC Two, followed by Mortimer and Whitehouse Gone Fishing at 9 and Daisy May and Charlie Cooper's Night Watch at 9.30. There's a new factual drama series on BBC One at 9, Prisoner 951, telling the story of British-Iranian citizen Nazanin Zaghari Radcliffe, who was imprisoned on spying charges in Iran for 6 years. On Channel 4 at 9, it's episode 4 of Summer Water. Your Sunday evening choices close with Gogglebox at 10 and Celebrity Gogglebox at 11.05 on Channel 4. Comedy Changing Ends at 10.05 on ITV. True Crime Presents at 11.15 on ITV. The Eubanks Like Father Like Son at 11.30 on BBC One and Turner The Secret Sketchbooks at 11.30 on BBC Two. Now for the programmes which are on at the same time, same channel, each weekday. Channel 4 has a triple helping of Everybody Loves Raymond from 7.50am and four episodes of Frasier from 9.10am. BBC One has Homes Under the Hammer at 11.30am and in the afternoon there's Find It, Fix It, Flog It on Channel 4 at 1.10. The regular soap slots are Emmerdale at 7.30 on ITV every weeknight, EastEnders 7.30 on BBC One every weeknight except Friday, and Coronation Street at 8 o'clock on Monday, Wednesday and Friday. And on to Monday. In the morning, American Pickers are in Illinois at 11.10 on Channel 4, and in the afternoon you have Make It at Market at 2.30 on BBC One and nature documentary A Wolf Called Storm at 4.30. Into the evening, you can go inside the world's most luxurious motorhomes at 8 o'clock on Channel 4, and at 9 you have the choice of drama series Summer Water on Channel 4, the continuing story of Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe in Prisoner 951 on BBC One, or the start of a new series on BBC One, Civilizations Rise and Fall. This episode features ancient Rome. At 10, there's the last episode of Leonard and Hungry Paul on BBC Two, and two episodes of 24 Hours in A&E on Channel 4. comedy series Changing Ends is on ITV at 10:20, and the true story of the publication of a leaked GCHQ memo in the run-up to the Iraq War is covered in Official Secrets at 11 on BBC Two. On Tuesday, in the afternoon, you have Make It at Market on BBC One at 2:30 and Liz Bonin's Wild Caribbean on BBC Two at 4:15. Your evening choices start with Mary Berry's A Lifetime of Cooking at 7:30 on BBC Two, which is followed by The Balkans, Europe's Forgotten Frontier at 8. Also at 8, you have Celebrity MasterChef on BBC One, week 2 of The Heats, and The Great Celebrity Bake Off for Stand Up to Cancer on Channel 4. At 9, there's the final episode of Summer Water on Channel 4, whilst on BBC Two, The World's Most Dangerous Roads goes to Iceland. From 10 into the early hours on Channel 4, you have the three-part series Ghislaine Maxwell, The Making of a Monster, taking you through her early life, relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, and conviction for child sex trafficking in 2021. Over on ITV at 10:05, the series Changing Ends continues, and on BBC Two at 11, Highland Cops goes to Skye and a raid on an abandoned property which officers believe could be a cannabis farm. Next, your programmes for Wednesday. Bargain Hunt travels to Helly near Exeter on BBC One at 12:15. Make It at Market is at 2:30, also on BBC One, and it's the final episode of Liz Bonin's Wild Caribbean at 4:15 on BBC Two. In the evening, your 8 o'clock options are Celebrity MasterChef on BBC One, Grand Designs House of the Year on Channel 4, and Ready Meals, What They Mean for You on BBC Two, which asks whether manufacturers could use greener technologies to cut the environmental impact of convenience foods. 24 Hours in A&E is at 9 o'clock on Channel 4, followed by Emergency Helicopter Medics at 10 and Britain's Most Expensive Houses at 11:05. Over on BBC One at 9, it's Episode 4 of Shetland, and on BBC Two at 11, historian David Olusoga continues his series about the British Empire. Now on to Thursday. On BBC One, Bargain Hunt is in Shrewsbury at 12:15 and Make It at Market is at 2:30. Over on Channel 4, American Pickers is at 11:10, and on BBC Two, you have filmmaker Gordon Buchanan, who spends a year with a family of black bears in Minnesota in The Bear Family and Me. Celebrity editions of Race Across the World at 8 and MasterChef at 9 are on BBC One, whilst over on Channel 4 you have George Clark's Remarkable Renovations at 8, followed by Cancer Detectives Finding the Cures at 9. It's the penultimate episode of The Ridge on BBC Two at 9:45, and Changing Ends continues on ITV at 10:35. There's a double helping of Gogglebox on Channel 4 at 10 and 11:35, and on BBC Two at 11:05 you have Civilizations Rise and Fall. Finally, on to Friday. American Pickers is on Channel 4 at 11:10, and at 2 o'clock you have Hope Street on BBC One, and Sarah Davies' Christmas Craft Off on ITV with The Bear Family and Me at 4:15 on BBC Two. Your evening choices kick off with Mortimer and Whitehouse Gone Fishing at 7:30 on BBC Two, and at 8 you have BBC One's Return to Paradise series or Channel 4's The Doghouse at Christmas. At 9 there's Lucy Worsley's The Witch Hunts on BBC Two and Gogglebox on Channel 4. Changing Ends continues on ITV at 10:20 and at 11 on BBC Two. The Beecham House, retirement home for opera singers, sets the stage for a stellar cast in the comedy drama based on Ronald Harwood's play Quartet. So that's it for this week. We do hope you found plenty of programmes to enjoy, and we look forward to updating you again next week.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, November 22nd. The 7% Solution stars Simon Callow as Sherlock Holmes. The Riddle of Holmes's Rickenback Falls disappearance is at last solved, and the real reason for Professor Moriarty's power is revealed. Radio 4 Extra It's at 6 in the morning on Saturday, 11 a.m. or 5 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra. Teller of the Unexpected is a biography of author Roald Dahl, also on Radio 4 Extra, 7:30 in the morning, 12:30 lunchtime, or 6:30 at night. Forbidden Britain, Brief Encounter Revisited, explores why that film's themes of love and guilt still stir the British conscience 80 years after its release. Radio 4 for Brief Encounter Revisited, 8 o'clock, Saturday night. Sunday, November 23rd, and the castaway in Desert Island Discs is Sir Salman Rushdie. Radio 4, 10 a.m. While an archive edition from 2007, science fiction author Brian Aldiss is the castaway on Radio 4 Extra, 11 a.m. or 5 p.m. Sunday. In an omnibus edition of 60 Degrees North, journalist Maliki Talak journeys from Shetland around the 60th parallel. Radio 4 Extra for this, 12:30 at lunchtime or 6:30 at night. The Czech Freedom Train looks back at events from September 1951, when a train from Prague was hijacked and driven from communist Czechoslovakia into West Germany. Radio 4, 5 o'clock, Sunday afternoon. James Blades, Pandemonium of the One Man Band, is recorded in front of a live audience at Snape Maltings in Suffolk and portrays the story of percussionist James Blades, who died in 1999. Radio 3, 7:15 p.m. And in hearing aids, poet Paul Farley addresses his hearing loss and finds out about the future of hearing aids and the supposed link between dementia and hearing loss. Radio 4 for this, Sunday night, 7:15. Turning on to those programmes then that are broadcast at the same time, every day, Monday to Friday, same radio station. So same radio station each day, same time, Monday to Friday, all working week. In Travels with Bob, Paddy O'Connell is joined by Border Terrier Bob as he explores the bonds people make with the places where they live. Radio 4 Extra, all week, 9:30 in the morning, Monday to Friday. Charity Ends at Home. It's a dryly comic murder mystery from 1992 on Radio 4 Extra at 11:30 in the morning or 5:30 at night. The End of Family explores the role of the family in modern life, beginning with the enduring appeal of marriage. Radio 4, all week, 11:45 in the morning. Sunshine and Laughter is Lewis Barff's biography of Morecambe and Wise from 2021. Radio 4 Extra, 1:30 in the afternoon or 7:30 at night, Monday to Friday. Materials of State explores the history of our national objects and symbols. The Union Flag, the Sword of State, the Ballot Box, Black Rod, Stone of Destiny. Radio 4, 1:45 every day this week. Composer of the Week is American jazz drummer and composer Max Roach, 1924 to 2007. Radio 3 at 4 o'clock each day. In Watching from the Wings, author, journalist and broadcaster Michael Goldfarb recalls his theatrical life as an actor. Radio 3, 9:45 p.m. Monday to Friday. And The Princess Bride, Bite-Sized Backstories by William Goldman, charts the background of events in the swashbuckling adventure The Princess Bride. Radio 4, 10:45 every night this week. On to the individual programmes then to listen to through the week, starting with Monday, November 24th. In Rumblings from the Rafters, Bill Paterson and Alison Steadman star as insects in Lynn Truss's Death Watch Beetle and Queen Wasp. Radio 4 Extra, 8 o'clock in the morning, 1 o'clock at lunchtime or 7 p.m. at night. Whatever Happened to Baby Jane Austen begins a new series of the comedy starring Dawn French and Jennifer Saunders as bickering celebrity sisters. Radio 4, 2:15 on Monday afternoon. If at first you don't secede, looks at the future of Scottish independence, exploring how events since the 2014 Scottish independence referendum may have changed public opinion. Radio 4, 4 o'clock. And BBC Inside Science is on Radio 4 at 8:30 p.m. on Monday. Tuesday, November 25th, the first of this year's Wreath Lectures is given by Dutch historian Rutger Bergman, who asks, what can be done to motivate the elite to tackle pressing global issues? Moral Revolution, A Time of Monsters, Radio 4 at 9 o'clock on Tuesday morning. The series, History's Toughest Heroes, tells the story of Native American warrior Crazy Horse, a horseman who led the Lakota tribe to victory against General Custer at the Battle of Little Bighorn. History's Toughest Heroes this week, Radio 4, 3 o'clock, Tuesday afternoon. Omid's Tapes, the Afghan memory keeper, joins California-based archivist Omid on his mission to preserve Afghan music, radio recordings, films and television shows from being erased by the Taliban. Radio 4 for this at 4 o'clock on Tuesday afternoon. And Peter White brings us his regular programme, In Touch, with news and information for people who are blind and partially sighted. Radio 4, 8:40 p.m. Wednesday, November 26th. In Being Bored, The Importance of Doing Nothing, Phil Jupilis argues that boredom is an essential part of creative life, but is under threat from distractions of the digital age. Radio 4 Extra, digital, at 10 a.m. or 4 p.m. could be part of the problem. This Week in History looks back at the events of this week in years past on Radio 4 at 11:40 on Wednesday morning. Choral Evensong comes from the chapel of King's College London on Radio 3 at 3. And The Lady's Paradise is a dramatisation of Emile Zola's 1882 novel about a woman who comes to Paris to find work and ends up at a glamorous department store. Radio 4 Extra, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, 9 p.m. And the second part is tomorrow, Thursday. Which brings us to Thursday, November 27th. In Our Time learns about Marjorie Kemp, the 14th century mystic who went on pilgrimages and dictated her life story, said to be the first autobiography in English. Radio 4, 9 a.m. The strange parallel world of Christian pop meets artists and band members of a neglected musical genre, including Joy Strings, the Salvation Army pop group. Radio 4 Extra, 10:30 on Thursday morning or 4:30 in the afternoon. This Natural Life returns for a new series, starting with author Sarah Perry visiting the Corvid Roost at Buckenham Cars in Norfolk. Radio 4, 3 p.m. And Radical with Amal Rajan offers his take on the week's news. Radio 4, 11 p.m. Finally, Friday, November 28th. And the food programme has the intriguing title, The Great Tartan Tea Swindle. Radio 4, 11 a.m. In Rare Earth, the programme explores how the work of Charles Darwin and his fellow naturalists hold up in today's world. Radio 4, just after the midday news. Mr. Waring of the BBC tells the story of Peter Waring, whose desire for a better life brought him fame and infamy. Radio 4 Extra, 3 o'clock or 9 p.m. on Friday. And Friday night is indeed music night, and it comes from Nottingham and presents performers from that city, including pianist Geneva Canna-Mason. Radio 3, 7:30 p.m. on Friday. That's it. Thank you to Wendy for the highlights this week. May I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable one of radio listening.
TNS Soundings.
Welcome to SVI Christmas Activities 2025. A warm welcome in what is a very chilly spell to the latest Christmas Activities newsletter from SVI. And may I be the first to wish you season's greetings if it's not too early, and it seems to get earlier every year. A quick pointer to a couple of the activities coming up that you might be particularly interested in. First, a trip to Lichfield Christmas Market on Thursday, December the 4th. On Tuesday, December the 9th, there's SVI's Big Bash Santa Christmas Party being held at the SVI office in West Bromwich. Towards the end, there's a taste of things to come in 2026, with a mention of some of the activities we hope to be arranging early next year. Don't forget to book early for some of these, and there is a cost associated with some of them, but you can pay using your card over the phone or in person at the SVI office. Along with these Christmas festivity events, we have a listing of the many regular events organised by SVI, which you're about to hear being read by Jan, one of our talking news readers.
Dear SVI members and friends, we've got a wonderful lineup of events and activities this month, and we'd love for you to join us. There's something for everyone, from festive treats and friendly chats to fitness sessions and Christmas celebrations. Read on to see what's coming up. SVI Rocks, SVI Office. Come along to our last two sessions of the year, the 26th of November and the 10th of December. SVI Rocks is open for everyone, so bring a friend and come and make some noise together. Bring your instruments, your pots, your pans, your musical voice, and join us for some rowdy rock fun. Let's talk about IT, Monday the 1st of December, 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m, SVI Office. Join us for an informal session where we'll chat about all things IT, whether you're a tech whiz or just getting started. Everyone's welcome. This month we will have Kevin Priest from the Black Country Housing and our special IT guest Andrew Billingham from the Beacon. We hope that together we can resolve some of your digital dilemmas. Tea and Toast Brunch with SVI, Wednesday the 3rd of December, 10:30 a.m. to 12 noon, West Bromwich Town Hall. Come along for tea, toast and a catch-up with friends, with a festive twist. We'll be serving sausage sandwiches or bacon baps, veggie options available, plus festive tunes and plenty of good company. Lichfield Victorian Christmas Market Trip, Thursday the 4th of December. Pick up at 9:30 a.m, return approximately 5 p.m. Wrap up warm for a day out exploring the charming Lichfield Victorian Christmas Market, or maybe a visit to the cathedral to look at the stunning Christmas tree festival. For the culture vultures, why not visit the Samuel Johnson Museum? Transport from West Bromwich bus station will be £15 per person, and you're free to do your own thing once you get there, or you can join in our suggested timetable. An 11 a.m. tour of the cathedral and Christmas tree festival, 1 p.m. visit to the Victorian Christmas Market. Booking and payment in advance is required for this trip. Santa's Big Bash Christmas Party. Tuesday the 9th of December from 12 noon to 3 p.m. at West Bromwich Town Hall. Celebrate Christmas in style in the beautifully refurbished Grand Hall and enjoy a turkey sandwich buffet, festive songs, dancing, quiz, raffle and a special visit from Santa himself. You'll be greeted with a complimentary welcome drink and tea and coffee will be available throughout. Please note that the venue won't be selling alcohol, but you're welcome to bring your own. Tickets are £10 per person, payable in advance or on the day, but booking is essential, so call or email us to reserve your place. Men's Group, Wednesday the 17th of December, time to be confirmed. Our men's group are meeting on the 19th of November to agree the programme of activities for the coming months. If you're interested in joining the men's group, please get in touch with the SVI office so we can keep you informed. Santa Festive Stroll in Dartmouth Park and the Sandwell Valley, Thursday the 18th of December. Meeting at 12 noon by the memorial in Dartmouth Park, we will join Santa and his merry helpers for a gentle stroll to the Sandwell Valley Visitors Centre, where we can purchase lunch or enjoy a hot chocolate and mince pie. Santa suits, elf costumes and other festive wear is encouraged. SVI Women's Group Festive Bottomless Brunch, Saturday the 20th of December, 1 p.m. to 2:45, Lucarelli Restaurant, West Bromwich. Let's end the year in style. Join us for our final event of 2025, a festive brunch at this popular local Italian restaurant. £29.95, you'll enjoy two light bites from the brunch menu, two cocktails of your choice and bottomless fizz for the duration of your visit of 1 hour 45 minutes. Bring your friends or partners for a fun, relaxed afternoon. Advance booking and payment are required, so don't delay. Contact us for menu details and to secure your place. Health and fitness activities this month. Supported gym sessions every Tuesday from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. at Portway Lifestyle Centre. Get active with fellow SVI members, whether you prefer the treadmill, exercise bikes or weights. Support is always on hand to help you get the most from your workout. It's a great way to stay fit, whatever the weather. Line dancing, every Tuesday, 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. at Dartmouth Central Club. Join Ray and Jean, our volunteer instructors, for fun-filled line dancing sessions. It's a fantastic way to stay active, improve your balance and meet new people. Our final session before Christmas will be on Tuesday the 16th of December. Aquafit in the therapy pool, Wednesday the 26th of November from 1 p.m. to 2 p.m. Portway Lifestyle Centre. Splash out with our final Aquafit session of the year. Enjoy gentle exercise in warm water. It's great for keeping flexible and easing aching joints. Work at your own pace and feel the benefits of moving in water. Showdown every Thursday morning from 10:30 a.m. at Portway Lifestyle Centre. A fast-moving interactive sport similar to table tennis and air hockey, designed for blind and visually impaired people, but anyone can play. Contact the SVI office for more information. Coming up for you in 2026. Tea and toast in the SVI Common Room, West Bromwich Town Hall, on Wednesday the 7th of January. Ray-Ban Metaglasses Awareness Session. Your chance to have a go with these amazing specs, Monday the 12th of January, 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Let's Talk About IT, Monday the 12th of January, 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. Active 60 Winter Warmer Lunch, date to be confirmed. Women's Group Pampas Treatments and Lunch, date to be confirmed. Other ideas for future activities: a once-a-month cinema night, trip to the West Midlands Police Museum to explore the lock-up. Bookings and payments. All activities must be booked in advance. Spaces fill up fast. Call 0121 525 4810 or email info@sandorvisuallyimpaired.org.uk to reserve your spot. We can now take card payments in person or over the phone. You can also pay by bank transfer or cash. Just get in touch and we'll help you with the details. We look forward to seeing you at one or more of our upcoming events. Let's make this a festive season, one to remember. Warm wishes from the SVI team.
TNS Soundings.
Hello, I'm Alastair Hutton and I'm reading Museums Under the Microscope, which has been written by Lindsay. The traditional picture which comes to mind when talking about museum exhibits is a series of rooms containing visual displays. These can be real artifacts or colourful backdrops representing something that can't be physically placed inside a museum, such as outer space or deep ocean environments. But museums are changing thanks to the appliance of science. Technology is now available that can help create interactive exhibits to entertain and educate visitors, often alongside additions for those with visual impairments, hearing problems, and other disabilities. The Make It Visible project is behind the welcome moves to ensure museum exhibits are more accessible. The Make It Visible research team comprised the British Natural History Museum's Dr. Alec Ball and PhD student Kate Burton, in conjunction with computer sciences specialist Dr. Catherine Holloway from University College London and Kenneth Ping from Zeiss Technologies. The team focused on enhancing accessibility and inclusion in museums across the United Kingdom through using microscope data translated from actual images to 3D models. Originally, they tested traditional model materials and then moved on to generating special scanner-linked software to operate 3D printers. Also working in this area is the Global Disability Innovation Hub. This is a national and international organisation which drives improved disability research and practices in public places to help ensure a fairer world. The Hub's work revolved around workshops with test groups of disabled adults and children to gain insight into adjustments that would help make museums more accessible. They made up museum-in-a-box workshop kits for testing by students from Linden Lodge School for the Blind in London. The boxes contained different microscope-based and tactile models, along with audio files, to demonstrate the Natural History Museum's Nature Overheard project. The audio allowed listeners to gain an insight into the soundscape of the natural world and think about what makes a healthy natural environment. Participants could also submit short recordings of their surroundings to an AI project which used software to identify natural sound variations, for example, insect behaviour in relation to traffic noise. The results of these research projects are already paying dividends in the shape of microscope-enlarged tactile 3D models in museums. For example, the Natural History Museum has a comprehensive selection from tiny butterfly wings up to a full-scale bronze dinosaur skull mounted in the museum's garden, and even tactile models of moon rock based on the genuine articles. London is not the only place to find accessible exhibitions, as museums in all parts of the UK are also playing their part, and here are a few examples. The Museum of Liverpool has a Curating for Change programme, which works alongside local people to develop improved sensory gallery tours, including tactile exhibits, many braille labels, and displays enhanced with smells to bring their history to life. In York, the Jorvik Viking Museum has created an indoor period street with immersive sights, sounds, and atmospheric smells of the Viking Age. Additional adjustments to help those with visual impairments, disabilities, and autism include handheld lanterns for the low-light areas, visual stories, and a smell map. St. Fagan's National Museum of History in Cardiff has traditional period open-air Welsh buildings with enhanced natural sounds of a working smithy, farm, and other buildings. There are also accompanying smells, such as the scent of fresh bread from the bakery. The museum's scheduled events include interactive Meet a Celt Iron Age reenactments and food festivals. The National Museum of Scotland in Edinburgh offers histories of their collections from the prehistoric to the present with visual stories, large print guides and sensory maps. Tours, where visitors are able to handle exhibits, can also be arranged, but these need to be requested in advance. In Belfast, the Titanic Museum, Belfast, offers a five-star experience with their new iconic building and the nearby historic slipway, which hosts the last remaining White Star Line vessel, the SS Nomadic. Both the museum building and ship have audio or historic discovery tours, textured flooring, and a shipyard ride, which, despite some size restrictions for power chairs, can accommodate guide dogs at the owner's discretion. Meanwhile, outside the major cities, the Nature in Art Museum and Gallery in Gloucestershire tested the water this autumn with its totally tactile exhibition. For a month, between mid-September and mid-October this year, the museum actively encouraged its visitors to touch the works of art on display, including sculptures of rhinos, lions, and other wild animals. There were also accompanying audio guides describing the exhibits. As well as making exhibits accessible to visually impaired people, sighted visitors were encouraged to wear blindfolds so that they could experience the exhibition from a different perspective. Interpretive technology can help all visitors immerse themselves in the collections that museums and galleries have to offer, but it's important not to forget that these ideas still need a human touch to flourish. Let us hope that more museums adopt these ideas and make more of their collections accessible to everyone.
TNS Soundings.
News and information from Sandwell Council. Council cracked down on fraudulent right-to-buy application, protects £750,000 of public funds. Sandwell Council has successfully prevented a number of fraudulent right-to-buy applications, protecting approximately £750,000 of public funds and ensuring homes remain available for local people who need them most. Following changes to the National Right-to-Buy Scheme last year, which reduced the level of discount available to tenants, Sandwell Council experienced a significant surge in application from tenants eager to benefit from the higher discount rates before the deadline. While the vast majority of applications were genuine, the Council recognised the potential risk of fraudulent claims and took proactive steps to safeguard public assets. through the diligent work of the Home Ownership Unit and Counter Fraud Unit, robust checks were carried out on all applications. As a result of these efforts, 10 right-to-buy applications have been stopped from proceeding due to concerns of fraud since the start of the year. In addition to protecting public money, the council has also recovered several council properties which are now being made available again to families on the housing waiting list. Investigations have further identified benefit and council tax overpayments, helping to recover additional funds for the borough. Councillor Vicky Smith, Cabinet Member for Housing at Sandwell Council, said, "This is an excellent example of teamwork and vigilance across our housing and counter fraud services. The surge in right to buy applications put real pressure on our teams, but their professionalism and attention to detail have ensured that public money and vital housing stock are protected for Sandwell residents. We want to reassure residents that while we support those who are eligible to buy their homes, we will continue to take a firm stance against anyone attempting to abuse the system. Sandwell Council remains committed to tackling fraud in all its forms and to maintain fairness and transparency in how council homes and resources are managed. To report suspected fraud, email sandwellcouncil@fraud_investigation@sandwell.gov.uk or you can call 0121 569 2650. People can also visit the council's online reporting webpage at sandwell.gov.uk/reportfraudmbc.
To end with, I've just got space to include Barry Lane's talk we had at the SVI Forum last Monday. So here it is to end this edition.
Hello. Right, I'm a little nervous, or as I say, a lot nervous. I've never done any public speaking before, so this is quite new to me. So when Sandra approached me to ask if I would speak today, I was a little hesitant, but here I am. We have to challenge ourselves, I guess, every now and then. So thank you, Sandra, for asking me. It's a real honour to be here today, so thank you for asking. I am registered blind, and I'm using my phone for my notes. A little bit about me, I guess. So I was born on the 6th of June 1974, so it's 51 years ago. And 10 years later, on the 6th of June 1984, I was diagnosed with RP, retinitis pigmentosa. So it's a welcome birthday present for me on my 10th birthday. What is RP? Some people might ask. Well, there's two main symptoms to RP. There's tunnel vision and there's night blindness. The causes of this is I don't know if people know, that your eyes have two different types of cells in them. There's rod cells and cone cells, millions of them. So with RP, it's the rod cells that are deteriorated over time, basically. So your cone cells help you detect light and detail, whereas your rod cells help you with your peripheral vision, your night sight, basically. So it's the rod cells that basically deteriorate over life, and RP can affect people indifferently and different times of their life, really. So I've met people with RP and they've only developed it in their 40s, and affects them from that point onwards. So it can develop at different times of life and at different paces. I've known people who've got RP who've still got very strong central vision. Well, I don't have that anymore. In my 20s and 30s, I lost majority of my sight. So at the moment, I just see shadows and light, and that's it, really. So I had a long period of time of developing my skills over time. I I grew up, family, myself, my brother, and my mum and dad. My brother wasn't blessed with visual impairment, he was blessed with full sight. So we were very competitive as children. So I could see, in my teens and young life, I could still see quite well to play sport. So we were very competitive, although due to him being fully sighted, he generally came out on top, unfortunately. But I felt that now, looking back, that's probably made me a stronger competitor. So then after I was diagnosed at 10, I then attended specialist schools, really. They don't tend to have many around anymore, so, and colleges. So I went to a school in Chingford called I've forgotten the name of it now, somehow. So I went to school in Chingford, and then I attended QAC, Queen Alexandra College, back in 1990. And one thing about sport, when you compete against sighted people and you're vision impaired, you do struggle, especially at football. I wouldn't see people coming in to tackle me because of my tunnel vision, and so I was struggled in fully sighted, playing against fully sighted people. But when you compete against people that are also sight impaired, and you've got quite a good ability, then you tend to realise you're actually quite good at this sport. So when I went to attended specialist schools, I was quite good at sport, and so playing football, I loved playing football, but I always felt that with my eyesight and my tunnel vision, I could really not compete even in VI football very well. So when I attended QAC, I was introduced into a sport called goalball. I'm like, what's goalball? Goalball is a sport that's played indoors, venue like we're in today. It's got a court which is the same size as a volleyball court, so it's 9 metres wide by 18 metres long, and there's a goal at each end of the court, so the whole goal spans 9 metres across. And the one thing about goalball is everyone's playing on a level playing field. Everyone is blindfolded, so no one can see at all, whether you've got a little bit of sight, a lot of sight or no sight, everyone's competed the same. So everyone's blindfolded. And you probably wonder, well, how do they play this ball? Well, the ball has got bells in it. So it's a very heavy ball. It's 1.25 kilograms. And you throw the ball as hard as you can along the floor or bounce it. So you throw the ball as hard as you can and you try and score the other team's goal. There's three people at each team. Three people stand in front of the goal, and you kind of play end-to-end, basically, trying to score their goal, bouncing the ball or throwing it along the floor. That's a bit about goal ball, really. So I was introduced to goal ball at QAC, fell in love with it, and quickly realised I was actually quite good at it. So I was highlighted as talented with playing for Queen Alexandra College at the time, and within 2 years, I was called up to the Great Britain team to go and train with the Great Britain team. But in 1992, I made my Great Britain debut and played in several international tournaments. Then in 1995, Great Britain got the chance to hold the Paralympic qualifiers. And to everyone's astonishment, we actually did quite well in that tournament and we finished third into one of the qualifying places. So we qualified for Atlanta Games, but that wasn't the end of the story, really, because we then had to convince the BPA, the British Paralympic Committee, Association Committee, that why send this amateur sport, goalball, to Paralympics? Because obviously it costs a lot of money to send us. But we had that battle and we won. So, yeah, so we attended Atlanta. So, I mean, that was 1996, so that's nearly 30 years ago. So it's a bit of a blur now, 30 years ago. We came ninth after 12. One of the most memorable games for me was we beat Spain 4-3. The reason I remember it is because the Spanish royal family were in the crowd. So I remember that one quite well. That was quite a good moment. And we did win our 10th playoff match against Netherlands. So they were the two memorable games, really. Some other memorable things about Atlanta 96 was when the Paralympians were travelling over to Atlanta, we found out that the people who organised the Olympics had forgotten the Paralympians were coming into town and started taking up the track. Luckily, someone realised that the Paralympians were coming to town and had to put the track back down. So that was quite amusing. So it kind of highlights really what a lesser sport or lesser games that people thought about the Paralympics back then, because lottery funding wasn't part of that then, and they haven't become quite as well known, or wasn't on TV, or wasn't publicised at all really back then. In fact, my kit that was given to me was, my tracksuit was two sizes too small, so I had to walk around with my arms, my sleeves on my tracksuit up by my elbows, and also the Paralympic badge was sewn over the Olympic badge. So that's how people, I guess, the organisers felt about the Paralympics back then. But obviously, since then, we've got lottery funding, and it's. I'm pleased to say that it's a lot more well known now, and we are Paralympians now are playing on a much better level playing field, really. So then after Atlanta, we finished ninth. The team pretty much disbanded. I decided at the time that I couldn't commit too much more to goalball at an international level. So I decided I wouldn't play for the men's team anymore. There was a lot of commitments. You had to play tournaments every other week. You had training sessions in between that. I was really developing myself as a person at the time. I'd been to QAC, did an engineering course, and couldn't find work in engineering. So I then decided that I would attend another college in Loughborough to learn business admin. And that was taking up my life, because I felt like I wanted to work, and I was trying to redevelop myself as a person. So in between Atlanta and Sydney games, I stepped back from international goalball, not realising that the team at that point kind of redeveloped themselves and then went and qualified for Sydney Paralympics. So I must admit, I was a bit gutted, but they went and qualified for Sydney. But also, my goalball performances were getting better and better. I was in my peak of my goalballing career. So it was, I guess, a matter of time, really, that they actually approached me and asked if I would like to step back into the team, and I did. So I was very fortunate, I must admit, back then, that I was welcomed back into the squad. And we then attended the Sydney Paralympics, which was an amazing experience. We'd had lottery funding then, and there was lots of training, additional training. We had support from physios, we had support from sports psychologists. It was a totally different world from Atlanta to Sydney. So yeah, again, I can't remember much about the games, to be honest. The individual matches, I was actually injured during the tournament because we'd overtrained, we'd had all this lottery money thrown at us, we weren't really used to it. One of the players became muscle bound and was told not to train. It was a bit of a mess at the time, really. But we went, we played, we came 12th out of 60 odd countries that played. It was an honour to be there. So we played in Sydney. A couple of interesting facts about Sydney is the Great Britain's swimming team didn't perform as well as they should have done, because they were too busy sunbathing in the holding camp. And then so there was a bit of an uproar about that. And also, some of the countries, the poorer countries that attended, didn't perform quite as well as they should have done either, because they overindulged in all the free McDonald's that was available in the athletes' camp. So it was quite, you just walk up and now order yourself a Big Mac every time, it's free. Oh, which is great, but not great for my sporting career, maybe not. So, yeah, so that was Sydney, really. We finished 12th, and, yeah, it was an amazing experience, really. Finishing off my goalball career, really, from Sydney, or up until Sydney, I've played in several world championships and European championships around the world, including America and European countries around Europe. I've coached the women's and the men's team at European Championships. I helped create the new governing body that is now called Goalball UK. I was part of that committee who actually set that up. And also, after Sydney, I set up my own goalball team called Goalball West Midlands, which were very successful. We won the national championships 10 years on the bounce. So my goalball career was quite long. So about 20 years, I dedicated my life really to to Goulburn. During Sydney, another chapter in my life started, whereas I met my wife, Rachel. So I thought I'd tell you about being blind parents of sighted children, which also has its own challenges, really. So me and Rachel married in 2005. We had our first child in 2011. His name's Isaac. And then in 2016, Reuben came along. And then 2018, we had Solomon. So, yeah, three young boys. And, you know, it's challenging when you're sighted having three children. But, yeah, being blind parents became a little bit more challenging for us, really. Especially schooling. So when we do schooling, we have all our letters come through the post. We have homework books that we have to help them with their homework. So being quite techie as I am, I've started to use techniques with technology, really. So I now use Be My Eyes to take a photo and use the AI to describe what the homework is and to understand better what the teacher wants. With their reading, I use Scene AI. So I use Scene AI to help me with their reading, to read their books. And I use generative AI, really, to understand what long equations are and stuff. I have to do that stuff again. So, quite techie. I'm quite glad it's around, really, to be honest, that can support me in my parenting. So that's quite good. So I don't know if people know that I work for the Beacon Centre for the Blind. I'm one of their IT and assistive technology trainers. So we support people who may be new to sight loss or also has sight loss that, you know, would like to use their devices better, like their iPhones or Android phones or computers. So we offer that sort of training here. I've been over to Samwell VI on a regular basis to teach someone how to use a screen reader. So if anyone's interested in learning more about technology and what is available, then, you know, we can support you at Samwell VI. That's certainly... Though I know there was a part of your report that earlier that said that if there is a shortfall there, we can come over and support your members and do that. That's not a problem. Yeah, please get in touch. We're here today. We've got some devices over on the desk. We've got the Hable One, the Hable Easy, Penfriend. We've also got a pair of demo Ray-Ban glasses. So if you want to come and have a look at those and see what they sound like, we've connected those up. If you want to come and see what they're all about, they seem to be the in thing at the moment in the blind community. So come and try them on and see if that if they really see what they can tell you. I don't know if anyone's got them. I always feel like I just start shouting out, "Hey Meta, what's the time?" and everyone's glasses start talking. So we also offer employment coaching, so we've got Fahima with us today who can offer some advice and maybe make a referral if anyone would like some support with getting back into the workplace. They say that only one in four people with visual impairment are actually of working age, are actually in employment. So I feel very fortunate that I am one of them, and I have worked for most of my life, really. I mean, I worked for British Gas for 12 years. I worked on their call centre. You know, I'm very grateful to British Gas because they supported me through my sight loss journey. So when I started the British Gas, I could still see a computer screen. By the end of my British Gas career, I couldn't. And they supported me all the way through that process. So with regards to software and training, really. So I'm very grateful to British Gas for supporting me through that. I also worked as... self-employed. I was self-employed for 8 years. I did accessibility assessments for an organisation called Live Tourism that won a contract with the Premier League. So I was paid to go to football matches, buy something in the shop, eat pies, and drink beer. So what a job! So yeah, it was great. So 8 years I did that. It was great. Unfortunately, the management changed at the Premier League and we didn't win the contract in 2022. So we then I then had to find other employment. And some people may know me from my time at Focus Birmingham. So I worked there for nearly 2 years before I joined the Beacon Centre for the Blind. And that's where I'm at now. So kind of towards the end of my speech, really. One other thing I was going to mention today is about what I call blind frustrations, really. I'm sure we've all have them, but little things such as people leaving a door half open when you're walking towards it and you end up banging your head or something off the door. And one of my cleaners left the cupboard door open to where the cups are kept, and I walked. Luckily, I kind of brushed it with the side of my head, but it could have been dangerous. What other ones? Oh, bin day. Another one I don't... school run a bin day. Oh, it's very frustrating. You walk down the road, you've not only got people to get around, you've got cars, and then you've got the wheelie bins on the way. So bin days, I don't like bin days. Getting on a very busy bus, that's another frustration. You walk on a busy bus and you're walking down the aisle and you're like tapping away, trying to find a seat, and no one talks to you, they're just ignoring you. Oh. Yeah, we've all been there, haven't we? Yeah, yeah. So just give me a seat. I've come to the conclusion that I'm going to just tell the driver, you're not allowed to leave until I'm sat down. And then stand in the middle of the bus and say, right, this bus isn't leaving until I sat, so someone might want to help me. The last one I was going to say is when people come up to you and go, hi, Barry. And then that's it. I'm like, well, how do I know who you are? I don't have I haven't got voice recognition software in my head that goes, oh, my voice is my password, no. You know, it doesn't then hit a click in my brain saying, oh, I know who that is. So I guess a bit of advice really for those of you who don't do this is if you do come up to someone and say, hi, Barry, please say, it's, and say your name. It just makes the whole experience so much nicer. And that's it really, guys. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you to all our volunteers who've read the Express and Star articles, James, Alison, Lauren, Sarbjit, Jenny and Kate. Thanks to Sue for picking all the articles, to Cyrita for uploading everything to the website and the Talking News Federation player, and for the podcast. Thanks to Ray for editing it all and putting it all together, to Gavin and Tony for the distribution on USB sticks. And also a big thank you to Jan for reading the SVI activities letter for us. Well, have a good week, everyone. Bye.
Thank you, Pam, and very nice to see you at the annual forum. We don't see much of one another, really communicate via email and sometimes Zoom meetings. And I was glad to be able to include Barry Lane's talk all about Gold Ball. It was mostly about that. What's coming up is also down Barry Lane Street, because it's about screen readers. That's coming up in In Touch for postal listeners. And that's what he does as a job these days at the Beacon Centre. He advises people, not just on screen readers, but on access technology and using computers and smartphones and all that sort of stuff generally. So it's very nice to have him at the meeting. Nice to see some of you there too. It's very cold now, and I have to go out to get another month's worth of prescriptions, and I'm going to tread very carefully because it's dropped below zero last night as I record this, so I'm going to be very careful going down the road. But we'll sign off for this week. Thanks to everybody who Pam has thanked, and do get the pen drives back to us as soon as possible. That's it for then for this week. Coming up is In Touch with a review of all the screen reader options for Windows. So we'll be back with you next week as usual with the last edition for November. Bye-bye for now.
To use our talk phone service to listen to Sandwell Talking News or leave us a message, phone 0121 699 6696. If you are using a landline in the 0121 area, then just dial 699 6696.